In just a moment, Generations with Kevin Swanson. But first, this. The World View in 5 minutes.
It's Wednesday, November 25th, 2015 AD. This is The World View in 5 minutes. I'm Adam McManus. Religious minority groups in Iraq are protesting a new law that would force some children to become Muslims. Catholic news agency reported a recently passed national charter could take religious freedom away from children and teenagers. Chaldean Catholics, Yazidis, Mandean, Kakai, and Baha'i minorities all opposed the charter, and many protested on November 4th. The World View spoke to Emily Fuentes of Open Doors, and she said the new law also would violate international standards for religious freedom and conscience.
We've seen it in other countries in the Middle East where it really complicates legal hearings and custody battles and all of those things. And then it really complicates it for kids when they grow up. They can't choose their religion. And so it's a very concerning law for all of those reasons.
Thousands of parents of public school students in Tennessee were alarmed to find out their children were being required to recite Muslim prayers and memorize historically inaccurate facts about the religion. They brought this to the attention of American Center for Law and Justice and the Christian Post. Now, the Tennessee State Board of Education has agreed to review the curriculum. The conservative law group described the board's decision as a victory, noting the curriculum review will take place in January 2016. In their statement, the ACLJ said, "We will be monitoring the planned changes at the state level and working with state officials to ensure that public school standards regarding world religions are factual, non-biased, non-indoctrinating, and in compliance with students' rights as protected by the First Amendment." Greg Locke, a local pastor of Global Vision Bible Church, called the curriculum absolute brainwashing of religion. Pastor Locke spoke to the World View.
They were having to, you know, make prayer rugs and learn what it means to have the five pillars of Islam. And so it wasn't just a quick overview, you know, here's the, you know, Islamic historical lesson. It's more like, here's what they believe, here's why they believe it. Whereas the problem with that is, if I were to go into the school and say, here's the, you know, five fundamentals of Christianity, here's the power of the gospel, here's the authority of the Word of God, there's no way they would let that fly.
Jacqueline Taylor, a 20-year-old cellist in the Asheville, North Carolina Symphony Orchestra, has lost her job. She says it's because of her faith. Taylor, a new member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, filed a civil rights lawsuit claiming the orchestra fired her after she asked for time off to observe the Sabbath. Taylor says she was fired when she asked to be excused from Friday night practice, the beginning of the Sabbath for Jews and Seventh-day Adventists. Sunday is the Sabbath for most Christians as they celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Isaiah 58:13-14 says, "If you turn back your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight and the holy day of the Lord honorable, if you honor it, not going your own ways or seeking your own pleasure or talking idly, then you shall take delight in the Lord, and I will make you ride on the heights of the earth." The Turkish military shot down a Russian warplane. They said they warned that plane to leave their airspace 10 times in 5 minutes on Tuesday. Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Turkey's decision to do so was a, quote, stab in the back, unquote, and it would have, quote, significant consequences, unquote, for its relations with Turkey. As a result, NATO called an emergency meeting in Brussels over the incident. An Al-Qaeda suicide bomber blew up six top-level ISIS militia in Syria on November 15th, gloating on Twitter about the heroic attack. The ISIS group, calling itself Yarmouk Martyrs Brigade, well known for its bloody and vicious hold over parts of the Golan Heights, was in the middle of a meeting when the bomber exploded in their midst. Apparently, the two terror groups are in an ongoing battle for territory north of Damascus near the Israeli border. ISIS is the bitter offspring of Al-Qaeda. As neurosurgeon Ben Carson's poll numbers begin to slide in Iowa and New Hampshire, he told CNN he thought he was the most, quote, misunderstood candidate, unquote, running for the GOP nomination for President of the United States. Senator Ted Cruz's numbers have skyrocketed him to a virtual tie with Donald Trump in some places and second to the real estate mogul in others as the primaries get closer. The Wall Street Journal reported Tuesday, anti-Trump GOP groups are teaming up now to fund an advertising blitz to keep Trump from winning the nomination. As many people take to the roads or the skies this week to travel for the Thanksgiving holiday, the U.S. State Department has issued a warning to all to, quote, be alert, unquote. According to FoxNews.com, the State Department has received information of possible planned attacks around the world by jihadists. Philippians 4:6-7 reminds us, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. There is nothing ambiguous about tomorrow's holiday, Thanksgiving. Count your blessings, take stock of God's goodness to you, and in everything, give thanks. For this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. 1 Thessalonians 5:18. And that's the worldview on this Wednesday, November 25th, in the year of our Lord, 2015. I'm Adam McManus. Seize the day for Jesus Christ.
Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. This is Kevin Swanson, your host, as we continue the battle for faith, family, and freedom in the Western world. And we are a small minority still fighting for the cause of freedom. And oh, by the way, if you would like to get my book on freedom and how to restore freedom for our children and grandchildren, this is a worthy battle that's been waged for 800 years. Be sure to grab a copy at our website, kevinswanson.com or generations.org. And when it comes to politics, we need to be very careful to distinguish between principle and strategy. We may agree on principle, that is, we as conservatives, as Christians, may agree on small government, decentralized government, God-fearing leaders, and the pro-life issue. But oftentimes we differ on strategy, that is, how to get there. And I've watched pro-life organizations break down through infighting on strategic issues. I've watched churches break down through infighting on strategy as well. And that's something of what happened with Paul and Barnabas, as one of them went off to Cyprus and the other up to Asia Minor. Well, strategies call for wisdom. If you're defending your strategy as the only possible strategy, and anybody who disagrees with you has left the reservation or completely abandoned orthodoxy, you may have a bit of a pride issue there. So we got to be careful on these issues. That is, moderate our dogmatism, especially when it comes to strategy. Specific political strategies are not going to save this nation, my friends. Only God can save us now. And I think we've made that point again and again on this program. A miracle from God that will save this nation. And it's going to have to be a change of hearts. It's got to have to be humility, repentance, and regeneration one by one amongst millions of people across this country. That's what this nation needs right now. And we always come back to this point. What we need is godly, God-fearing leaders. But the problem is that God-fearing leaders are generally elected by a God-fearing people who are educated in God-fearing schools, and we don't have much of that much anymore. If you don't have God-fearing leaders and God-fearing judges, they won't abide by the Constitution and God's laws on the bench. No Constitution can possibly save a nation where you have a lack of God-fearing leaders. Well, that's the bottom line. Yet every God-fearing leader has to do something tomorrow. He can't just sit around and do nothing. So some are suggesting that one good strategy might be the Article 5 Constitutional Convention as a good strategy to assure freedom or decentralized federal governments, or a re-energized 10th Amendment. Now, some of my conservative Christian friends go one way on the issue, some go the other way. So what we're going to do on this edition of the program is take up both sides. We're going to look at the pro and the con on the Article 5 Convention on this edition of the program. First up will be Senator Kevin Lundberg from the Colorado Senate. And welcome back to the program, Kevin Lundberg.
Well, thank you very much. It's great being with you.
We're taking a look at solutions, and you're on a break right now. Thankfully, when the legislature is out of operation, it's just a breath of fresh air for the rest of its citizens, so don't have to worry about our liberties being curtailed. But
Right. And here in Colorado, we do have a part-time legislature, which means 4 months out of the year we're in session, and the other 8 months we're back home, not making law. It's still kind of a busy time for us individually, but your freedoms are more protected, you might say, or what freedoms we have left.
Yeah, at least on the state level. Sadly, the federal government is a little bit busier curtailing our freedoms and centralizing power. And that's the angle I want to take today, Senator. As a state legislator, I know you're concerned about the power grab at the federal level, the Supreme Court's arbitrary, lawless rule, so to speak, ignoring the Constitution, sort of making up law as they go. And then there's Obamacare. That was a recent example of that. Tell us a little bit, do some group therapy for a second. Tell us what it's like being a conservative Republican senator in the Colorado legislature with the federal government breathing down your neck.
Well, I've been there for over 12 years now. And what I have found is the state legislature and the state governments are really the lapdog of Congress and the president and the Supreme Court. Our nation was founded on a principle of federalism, where there's a balance between the authority at the federal level and the authority at the state level. And they're to balance each other out. But what we've developed into is this centralized government system where the states are simply, you might say, the emissaries for the wills and wishes of the federal government. And it's been this insidious growth that's occurred through our nation's entire history. Mm-hmm. But it's gotten to the point that we've got to fix this.
Yeah.
You know, we're up against the wall on a couple of things. One, we've got an $18+ trillion debt, and that's more zeros than anybody can actually comprehend. But that's because Congress cannot control its spending. And then when it comes to our liberties, Obamacare is a perfect example of the wholesale takeover. And we thought, well, maybe if we just change the political parties in Congress that'll fix it. Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the Supreme Court will actually recognize that this is in violation of the Constitution.
Yeah.
Well, they turned that on its head.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen from the federal side. So I know that as a state legislator, the only way we're going to find a solution is if the states reassert their authority and their responsibility.
Yeah. Tell us what's happening in Colorado by way of Obamacare. Where is this state headed?
Well, we have an amendment that will be on the ballot next November where the proponents of a single-payer system, in other words, almost full socialized medicine, they have this measure on the ballot. It's called Amendment 69, and it's a 10% tax on everybody's income, raising $25 billion in additional tax revenue. It has no exceptions, so things like Medishare or Samaritan Ministries will not be allowed in Colorado, or at least everybody will be forced in the other system, so it really wouldn't be practical. There's a 21-member board that will run this entire system that is not answerable to anybody but themselves, essentially. This is a system that makes Obamacare look like a very weak sister to the socialism they really want to put in place. The control that they desire is insatiable, and this amendment that we're looking at here in Colorado is proof of it. Hmm.
Senator Lindberg, let's talk solutions, and I know you're into solutions. It's difficult sometimes when we feel outnumbered to go up against this rising socialist trend across the nation. But talk to us a little bit about solutions. When we're looking at Article 5 specifically, how would that be a solution in your mind?
Well, Kevin, I mentioned to you that our nation was established on the principle of federalism, that balance of power between the state and the federal government. And it was actually folded right into the Constitution within Article 5, which is the article that deals with amending the Constitution. The Constitution has been amended 27 times, but it's always gone through Congress. Congress initiates it. Well, if you read Federalist Paper number 85, it addresses that in this sense. It says that if the federal government ever got out of control, we put within Article 5 the provision that the states can initiate amendments. And that is what we commonly refer to as Article 5, or the use of it today. Okay. And there's a very strong movement across our country. We're actually 7 states away from calling a convention to create a balanced budget amendment. I believe that's an important step, not just because we need a balanced budget, but because the states need to tell Washington, D.C., no more. We've got to take the keys away from you because you've proven yourself to be incapable of handling it. And we'll pull this back to where the Constitution was really created and intended initially.
Why are the states, or why would the states be more conservative and be more likely to be disciplined on these issues than the Congress?
Well, if you're saying disciplined within the sense of balancing a budget,
yeah,
most states are already required to do that, and we do live within our means.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to just look at the political structure across the nation, the makeup today, most states, so over 30 states, are actually controlled by the Republican Party, which is the more conservative of the two parties. You know, if there's a time that the states should be exercising their true constitutional authority, I'd say now's the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another element here, too. I made reference to the national debt. $18 trillion is not sustainable. And $20 trillion or $25 or $30 trillion would be completely disastrous. Well, we're headed down that road so quickly that we're going to see it before our kids grow up.
Hmm.
And I don't know if the economy will actually handle that staggering a debt. We have to take action, and as I say, we're very close for the balanced budget amendment to become a reality in that first step. And understand, it's just the first step. All the states have the direct authority to do is to call for a convention to create an amendment, and then just like if Congress were to create it, it goes back to the states again, and it takes 3/4 of them to say, okay, we'll do it. Well, I think that's an important point, and I also believe that the most significant point is that the states will finally be exercising that authority that was vested in them initially and tell Congress, tell Washington, D.C., that you're not fully in charge, that you have to share this power even as our Constitution was originally designed to do.
There's a concern out there among some conservative friends, and I have to say I have friends on both sides of this, as you well know, that something like this could turn into something like a runaway convention, people taking the wrong turn on this. What are the odds of that happening as far as you're concerned?
Well, the odds of that happening are close to zero, if not zero, because the same mechanism for ratifying amendments is always in place, which is it's going to take 3/4 of the states. Whatever a convention to create amendments does, it simply puts the proposal out before the individual states. And then the states have the individual authority and responsibility to either accept or reject whatever the amendment is. And understand, we've done it 27 times. Mm-hmm. It's just that we've done it through Congress. And anything Congress is not going to do is what the states need to do. But and I know a lot of good friends of mine have some deep concerns on this as well, but I've looked at this very carefully, and I've examined every particular concern they have, and I don't find them to be substantial enough to stand in the way of what really is the constitutional framework that was put in originally. Again, go back and read Federalist number 85. It's very clear within that document.
Senator Lundberg, you know, as I look at what's happened in Washington already and what happens with the left-leaning court at just about every level, I wonder if, and the cynic in me is saying, I wonder if an amended constitution would do any better than the original constitution if we have men and women on the bar, on the court, that will not abide by the Constitution of the United States. What's your thought on that?
The political process is one of engagement and action. If you have a fear that something may go wrong, therefore you'll do nothing, I will guarantee that the worst will occur, because the other guys, you might say the bad guys, are fully engaged in the process to change things. Now, you made one comment in there as well. You said, well, shouldn't we just stick with the original Constitution?
Mm-hmm.
That is, the reality is we have a Constitution that has been amended 27 times.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
I'm calling right now for one amendment in particular, and that is one requiring that Congress and Washington, D.C. lives within their means. That's an amendment I believe that is very appropriate. And if Congress were to come up with a real balanced budget amendment, you see, I don't even think they would do it. If they came up with it, they'd give enough outs, you know, exceptions to the rule that they could just blow it apart. But it takes somebody from the outside to really make it happen correctly. And that's what the nation was founded on, is that balance of power. It's not just balance between the three branches of government, but it's a balance between the levels of government, the federal government, and the sovereign authority of individual states. I have confidence, frankly, more confidence in the sovereign states making the right decision, because there's this competitive factor within all 50 states, whereas with Congress, it's really just one unified body, and they're always going to do things within their best interest, their self-interest. Well, it's that enlightened self-interest that will occur when you have 50 states, and each state has 49 others that they're competing with. I believe we'll come to the right solutions, even as we have in numerous occasions. You know, the first 10 amendments that were put in place are called the Bill of Rights. And I don't think you'll find anybody who will say, well, those were a bad idea. I want to put one more good idea in place for balancing a budget. And I'd like to put some other limits on D.C. as well. I'd like to put term limits on members of Congress. Mm-hmm. I would like to see some limitation on the Supreme Court. I'd like to see some regulatory relief that is constitutionally required, rather than simply assume that they're somehow going to change course after 200 years of going the wrong direction.
Well, one thing is for sure. I just finished a book called Freedom, and I think I handed you a copy of that last week. But I've concluded that the only possibility for sustaining freedom anywhere in the Western world, anywhere in the world, has always been when the local magistrates, the lower magistrates, the state magistrates would flex a little muscle against the rising tyranny that comes down from the large federal states. And that's exactly what you're proposing to do. And I think any time that we push the 10th Amendment, which, as you know, is critical for the states, I think we're going to see a healthy governance in America.
It is going to go the right direction. Now, to preserve our freedom requires, of course, vigilance in many areas. But when it comes to putting the controls on the government, you start with the Constitution, where there's a limitation on what they can do. And then you're right. You put in the hands of the lesser magistrates, the states and even the locals, you know, like your local sheriff needs to exercise their authority and responsibility. Governors need to stand up and say, you know, this is wrong, like many governors are doing right now with the wholesale admittance of a lot of people through a refugee program that might have some real problems. That's another program, I know. But all of those things require that balancing factor of somebody other than just, you know, the king or the oligarchy of nine members on a court. They have to live within controls as well. Freedom grows as the government is controlled. Freedom diminishes as the government grows.
Yeah. Yeah. If there was one thing you could do to Washington, D.C. right now, if there was one realignment of power, or if there was a restructuring of one of the branches of governments, what would it be? And if you could do whatever you wanted?
Well, realistically, within political terms, that's why I am so actively involved with Article 5. I'm national co-chair of the Article 5 State Legislators Caucus, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've looked at it, and in a realistic sense, the best thing that can happen is for the states to flex their constitutional authority and muscle and tell Congress, back off. You don't hold all the keys of power in government.
All right.
That's, you know, it's not only what I would like to see, but it's what I'm working to see happen.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Senator Kevin Lundberg on this edition of the program, taking the pro side on this. In a moment, we'll talk a little bit about the con side. But Article 5, a strategy to address the rising federal state that's happened in the United States. Senator Lundberg, thanks again for joining us. We appreciate your battle for freedom over the last, 12, 14 years.
Thank you. We stand shoulder to shoulder, always doing what we can where God bless us.
And we'll be back in just a moment, friends. The mark of a good father, according to Jesus in Matthew 7:11, is that he knows how to give good gifts to his children. He would not give his child a stone or a serpent. He would give him that which is nutritious and helpful. Now, Christian parents, if you're like me, you are constantly on the search for good gifts for your children. You're probably tired of cheap China junk and expensive toys that break within a month or two. That's why the Generation staff has spent the last 6 months scouring magazines, checking out samples, interviewing Christian parents, and identifying the very best books for our children. We look for creative presentation, substantive messages, biblical integrity, identifiable characters, and riveting stories. We have sponsored a child picture book contest called Nurturing Little Hearts, and we begin to publish the very best of children's books over the next year or two. But find good gifts for your children. That's a really good thing. We have an entire new section of children's book selections at our website for good gifts that you can get for your kids. Find it at generationswithvision.com. That's generationswithvision.com. And welcome back to the Generations Radio broadcast, friends. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today as we take a look at where America is today and solutions. What are the best solutions? What are the best strategies by which we can reverse some of the negative trends we've seen and reestablish a vision of liberty? Get back to some of the principles on which the nation was founded. And joining me is Art Thompson. He's CEO for the John Birch Society. Also written a new book called International Merger. And he joins me now. Art, welcome to the Generations broadcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Taking a look at where we are today, Art, you know, we've complained a bit on the rise of socialism in this country over the last number of years. We've had 8 years of Barack Obama, and before that, of course, George W. Bush, and a fairly massive increase in government under George W. Bush as well. Can you just give us a sense for where America is today and where she's headed?
Well, it's something that actually every individual there can measure for themselves year by year. Let me give you a quick way of judging it for yourself. If you get the Communist Manifesto written by Karl Marx,
yeah,
and you go to the portion in there that says, these are the 10 steps we need to do in order to communize a country. In other words, socialize it. Mm. Socialism was a bad word back in those days, so they invented a new word called communism. Now, today it's exactly the opposite. But basically, this is the primary document for all socialists. And those 10 steps outline what they need to do to communize or socialize a country. And if you go down all those 10 steps and in your mind say to yourself, how near are we towards 100% of implementing this step? Add them all up, divide them by 10. That tells you exactly the percentage where we are in socializing the country. Pretty simple, really.
Yeah. And we're continuing to make some progress in the increase of government purview in our lives under the recent administrations as well.
Oh, it's bad.
Yeah.
And really, this the ultimate solution when it comes right down to it is obeying the Constitution.
Yeah.
We don't have people that do that, either in Congress or the administration or the Supreme Court, as far as that goes. Our forefathers knew what human nature was all about. They'd studied history. They know the history of government, the nature of government. And they made a document called the Constitution, which pretty much protected us from nearly every aspect of government gone amok, as long as it was adhered to. And we're not adhering to it today. And if we just get back to the Constitution, it would be great. Balancing a budget, for instance, is one of the biggest things right now on the minds of a lot of conservatives. We cannot, I don't care what amendment you have or what institution you use or method you use, to try and alter the Constitution in order to have a balanced budget, if it does not take into account the 16th and 17th Amendments and their repeal, then you will never be able to alter the nature of government in the direction it's going right now, or limit the size of government or the amount of taxation.
And
it's impossible.
Refresh my memory, 16th and 17th Amendments.
Okay, the income tax is the 16th Amendment.
Right. Okay.
17th Amendment is the direct election of senators. Now then, it was illegal to have an income tax the way our forefathers put the Constitution together. They knew that if the federal government had the ability to directly tax companies and business, they could directly control companies and business and individuals.
Hmm.
You see, it was illegal to tax the individual by the federal government, but they tried it. It was found unconstitutional. The first time it phased out, they passed another bill, and it went before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. It's unconstitutional. And so they had to have an amendment in order to directly tax the individual. The thing about the 17th Amendment is this. Everybody thinks, because we've been taught, I was taught in public schools, that, hey, the 17th Amendment was really good because it made senators directly accountable to the voter. The problem with that was that we have two houses. One house is supposed to be directly accountable to the individual, which is the House of Representatives. The individuals are supposed to directly elect that person, whereas the states had their representative in the Senate, and the state legislatures appointed the state senators.
Right.
Now, this is why they did that. You see, the government used to operate simply on tariffs, excise taxes, luxury taxes, that kind of thing. If the budget went over, then the states were dunned a portion to their population of that state for the remainder to make up the balance of the federal budget. So a lot of times the House of Representatives would put a lot of pork in there, and the Senate, because they represented the states that had to foot the bill, said, no, you don't really need this. We are only going to do what government is authorized to do. Now, if they voted for that pork, when they got home, the legislature said, hey, we're just not going to reelect you to represent the state government, where we have to pay all this money because you voted for big government and all the rest of it. And so that's what got killed in the 17th Amendment, was the arrest, the brakes, if you will, on the federal budget by the Senate, because they represented the states that had to pay for it. And that's how we used to tax in this country up until 1914.
Well, now we're having to address, you know, where we are now. A lot of conservatives are looking at a strategy, Article 5, Constitutional Convention, and you're saying no. on that. Give us some reasons why this is not a good strategy.
Well, first of all, let's use a little logic. If the Congress and the administration and the Supreme Court are not following the Constitution now, what makes anyone believe they would follow a new amendment if it truly did balance the budget or bring government under control? These people are out of control because of a ignorant electorate. Now, I'm not insulting the electorate. I'm not saying they're stupid. I'm saying they lack information and they lack knowledge. Therefore, they're ignorant about our own government anymore because they haven't studied the Constitution. And the thing is that if we do follow the Constitution the way it's written now, even with the 16th and 17th Amendments, we can balance the budget and bring things under control. Now, a lot of conservatives are being sold the idea that we need an Article 5 convention or a conference of the states, put any label you want to on it, in order to bring government under control. But what they don't understand is that there are an awful lot of socialists out there that want the Article 5 convention as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's millions of dollars being poured into this campaign. Chartered airplanes, people being flown all over the place, daily emails, social networking, stuff being put in the mail, very glossy, very professional things to convince the legislators that they need to do this sort of thing. Today, in today's atmosphere, we don't even know who the delegates would be from each individual state. We don't know. Nor do we know how they would be appointed or elected, whether it be by the people or by the legislature. So in today's political atmosphere, we're asking for a pig in a poke of saying, well, don't worry about it. We're going to get these people together and we're going to fix this. Well, who are they going to send? We don't have George Washington and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and those people sitting down. We've got the neocons, the rhinos, that would probably be appointed from the Republican side and the socialists from the Democrat side. So it's fraught with danger. The precedent was the original convention, which James Madison said when it was all over, I hope this never happens again because I worry about the future of this country if we do have another convention.
Mm-hmm.
But the original convention did not do what it was instructed to do, and that was to amend the Articles of Confederation. Instead, they threw them out and started from scratch. Now, there are a lot of people on both sides of the ledger, so to speak, of the political spectrum, that really want to change more than what they say up front. There are those that want to completely rewrite it. There are those that want to have every state based on a more of a democratic situation in the Senate, rather than each state being equal in the Senate. There are those that want to do away with the Second Amendment. All they want to do is put a couple of little words in there. For instance, you have to keep the right to keep and bear arms in a militia,
yeah.
And that's a big difference. We don't have a militia today, so that would mean, hey, nobody can keep and bear arms. Mm-hmm. And look what happened in Paris because the people didn't have the right, and they don't have concealed carry and things like that mm-hmm. in France. In fact, they're using all of these terrorist actions to clamp down even more on the people, not just terrorism. Mm-hmm. I mean, hey, the government's never been able to protect people from terrorism without 100% control, and nobody wants that.
Conservatives interested in Article 5 are wanting to exert some muscle on the state side against the centrist control, the federal control. And is there a better strategy for reasserting the 10th Amendment, the rights of the state against a rising federal state?
Well, sure. It's called nullification. That's your best route. We're seeing that happen right now, provided if the governors do what they say they're going to do, and that's prevent the immigration of Syrian refugees into their states. There's more than half of them that have already said, no, we're not going to allow that.
Yeah.
The states can actually nullify federal law under the 10th Amendment. It's just that they rarely do. It is not an easy process, but it is it's like everything under the constitutional government that we have. It's a slow process so that people really think things through and say, wait a minute, this is good, this is not so good, so on and so forth. But at any rate, nullification can work. It was done with ID. It was done in any number of different ways in the past, as long as the state legislatures have the intestinal fortitude to implement it. Mm-hmm. But too many of them are let's say that their rhetoric doesn't match their action, or vice versa. And so they pander to the voter and that sort of thing, but they don't really stand up. They're unwilling to sacrifice their own well-being for the people, like our founders did. I mean, most of these guys that were involved in the War of Independence lost something.
Yeah.
And today nobody wants to lose anything. They want this and that and the other. But as long as I don't lose anything in the process. But liberty takes work. Liberty takes sacrifice. Liberty takes responsibility. And unless the people that we're voting for are willing to do that, I don't care what kind of amendments you have in the Constitution, it's going to be a problem. And I always, everywhere, I've talked to tens of thousands of people over the last few years, and I've always asked the question, is this country moving towards socialism? I've only got one guy that said no. And I said, whoa, you're the only one that's ever said no. He says, we're already socialist. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, getting back to the point, nobody wants to, well, let's say the vast majority of Americans do not want socialism. So why are we moving towards socialism? It's because somebody wants it that way. Somebody's organizing it that way. Somebody's planning it that way. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, regardless of what you think of him, did say a couple of very quotable things, and one of them was that if anything happens in politics, you can bet it was planned that way. People think up ideas. People plan ideas. People organize ideas. People finance ideas. Nothing happens in politics unless people plan it that way. So if we're moving towards socialism, somebody, some entity, some group wants it that way. Just for instance, we have about 70 of them have outed themselves, about 80 men and women in the National Congress, most of them, almost all of them in the House, who are members of the Social Democrats, which are the official representatives to the Socialist Internationale. That's a clue as to what's going on in Congress. Now, they don't talk about it in the media, but if you go online and look up Social Democrats, and look up who are members of the Social Democrats in Congress, you'll get a list. You can see whether or not your congressman is part of this Socialist Internationale. Now, he doesn't or she doesn't call themselves a socialist. They call themselves a Democrat or a Republican or something like that. But these people are organized. And until we understand that we have to out-organize them, that we have to educate the electorate, and do the work necessary to do that, we're never going to change anything in this country. And I'll say this is the reason why. If we, by some strategy, are able to rectify a problem today, it will revert to a problem tomorrow because the electorate are not informed about the Constitution and their basic rights. So any solution met today will be worthless tomorrow, unless we have an informed electorate. And a lot of people don't like to do that. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Work is one of those four-letter words in the English language that nobody wants to use.
Well, something like 57% of Americans are getting some kind of a check from the government, and that's not making things easy either. Seems like Americans are more and more seeking security in the socialist state, so there's that end of it as well.
Well, you always have to pay the piper.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you study, what made Mussolini powerful, what made Hitler powerful, Stalin, all the rest of these guys, it was simply because they were able to, with a combination of fear and handouts, control the population.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to understand that we have to stand up for ourselves. We have to protect our own homes. We have to assume civic responsibility. For our neighborhoods and for our cities, and get involved. find out what's going on in our local government, on our council and the counties, become actively involved in the political process, but also study the Constitution. Form study clubs and study the Constitution. There's lots of videos out there right now that you can use to do that, and we sell some of them. And if you go to jbs.org, John Birch Society, jbs.org, you can find out some of the materials you can use in your own neighborhoods with your own family and at work and that sort of thing to inform people, not just on the issues, but on the basic principles on which this country was founded. That's so important.
It's interesting that Americans are turning away from the establishment candidates for the 2016 presidential, at least the Republican nomination. Is that a good sign that they're moving more and more towards the populist candidates, or could be a good sign?
It could be a good sign. I know it's a good sign on many levels. The problem it's a blessing and a problem at the same time with us and the John Birch Society. We never endorse anybody, and it's for a lot of reasons. But at any rate, there are some hopeful signs in the Republican side of the ledger. The problem is that we're dealing with a media that really attacks things that are going on. Now, my next remark is no way an endorsement for or against any candidate. But when Trump got up and said that, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is the back door for China to come in and rule Asia, and everybody poo-pooed him, but he was exactly right. We've got stacks of material that point out that even the negotiator for the United States has as a long-range goal of including China in the TPP, and yet it's being sold to conservatives as a block to China, and it's not. There are a lot of problems in there, and I would invite anybody to go to Senator Sessions' website and look at his remarks relative to the TPP. So in this debate, what I'm saying is, and the point I'm making is that even when the right things are being said, the media and other candidates shoot them down and don't give them the time to answer precisely what they're talking about. There's some good and bad in all of the Republican side of the ledger, but I have come pretty much to the opinion that I can disagree with a guy on an issue or two. It's a matter of whether I can trust him.
Yeah.
If he's an honest guy, then I can deal with that. If he's a dishonest fellow, then what do? You can't deal with that at all. You can never trust him.
Yeah.
Let me give you an idea. This is kind of a funny little vignette, but I say there are 90 men and women in the United States House of Representatives that are honest. Now, how do I arrive at that figure? Because 90 live in their offices. They can't afford an apartment in Washington, D.C., in addition to their home back in the district.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually live in their office.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
And it tells me they're not on the take.
Yep.
Nobody's helping them.
Yep. You're basically saying Exodus 18:21, the old requirement for leadership in the Old Testament was men who fear God, hate covetousness, and love the truth. So it's basically just the basics. And I think it is the fact that we don't have men with a character to lay down their lives, their sacred honor, and their reelection on the line for the cause of principle, and to maybe even save the republic by not going into another $10 trillion of debt over the next 10 years. That would be a blessing if we had some with the character to take that stand, even if it was unpopular, and even if it would require us to tighten the belt and refuse welfare programs to some special interest group out there. So I think it always boils down to the character of the people who lead, and we just don't have much character in Washington right now. And changing the Constitution is not going to solve that problem. We've got to get good leaders in place, righteous leaders who fear God first and foremost.
Absolutely. Now, there are some very, very good men and women in Congress, but you never hear about them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I get up on the Hill about every 4 months, I suppose, and meet with several of them. Mm-hmm. And even some of the good ones have not so good staff. One of the problems is not just the the person that we elect, but the staff that's hired, and the established parties, they do everything they can to get their personnel hired by these freshmen, because the freshmen go up there totally ignorant of what to do. They don't know where their office is going to be. They don't know how many people they can hire. They don't know where to park the car. They don't know how to get a bill through. And so that's the moment when the established parties get a hold of them and give them orientation. And in the process of orientation, they give them all sorts of help. And one of the pieces of help they give them is, here are 2,000 resumes of people that we've trained to help you, you know, in your work here in Congress. And so these people are more beholden to the party than they are the individual that hires them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've had people actually pull me into a stock room, staff members to pull me into a stock room to talk to me on the QT, because they didn't want the other staff members in their office to even know what they thought. I mean, that's how bad it is in some places.
Folks, Art Thompson is Chief Executive Officer of the John Birch Society at jbs.org on the web. Art, thank you very much for joining us today on the Generations broadcast. We appreciate your inputs today. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.